You're right. That email just might work. Z, H said, slapping me on the back. You are an evil, sublime genius. When that email goes out, the media will go apeshit. The word will spread like wildfire. By this time tomorrow, every avatar in the Oasis will be headed to Thonia. Let's hope so, I said. Oh, they'll show up all right, Artemis said. But how many of them will actually fight once they see what we're up against? Most of them will probably set up lawn chairs and eat popcorn while they watch us get our asses kicked. That's definitely a possibility, I said. But the clans will help us for sure. They've got nothing to lose. And we don't have to defeat the entire Sixer army. We just have to punch a hole through it, get inside the castle, and reach the gate. Three of us have to reach the gate, H said. If only one or two of us make it inside, we're screwed. Correct, I said. So we should all try extremely hard not to get killed. Artemis and H both laughed nervously. Shoto just shook his head. Even if we get the gate open, we still have to contend with the gate itself, he said. It's bound to be harder to clear than the first two. Let's worry about the gate later, I said, once we reach it. Fine, Shoto said. Let's do this thing. I second that, H said. So, you two are actually going to go along with this? Artemis said. You got a better idea, sister? H asked. She shrugged. No, not really. Okay then, H said. It's settled. I closed the email. I'm sending each of you a copy of this message, I said. Start sending it out tonight to everyone on your contact list. Post it on your blogs. Broadcast it on your POV channels. We've got 36 hours to spread the word. That should be enough time for everyone to gear up and get their avatars to Thonia. As soon as the Sixers catch wind of this, they'll start preparing for an assault, Artemis said. They're going to pull out all the stops. They might just laugh it off, I said. They think their shield is impregnable. It is, Artemis said. So I hope you're right about being able to shut it down. Don't worry. Why should I be worried? Artemis snapped. Maybe you've forgotten, but I'm homeless and on the run for my life right now. I'm currently logged in from a public terminal at an airport, paying for bandwidth by the minute. I can't fight a war from here, much less try to clear the third gate, and I don't have anywhere to go. Shoto nodded. I don't think I can stay where I am either. I'm in a rented booth at a public manga cafe in Osaka. I don't have much privacy, and I don't think it's safe for me to stay here if the Sixers have agents out looking for me. Artemis looked at me. Any suggestions? I hate to break it to you guys, but I'm homeless and logged in from a public terminal right now, too, I said. I've been hiding out from the Sixers for over a year, remember? I've got an RV, H said. You're all welcome to crash with me, but I don't think I can make it to Columbus, Vancouver, and Japan in the next 36 hours.
I think I might be able to help you guys out, a deep voice said.
We all jumped and turned around just in time to see a tall, male, gray-haired avatar appear directly behind us. It was the great and powerful Og, Ogden Morrow's avatar. And he didn't materialize slowly the way an avatar normally did when logging into a chat room. He simply popped into existence, as if he had been there all along, and had only now decided to make himself visible.
Have any of you ever been to Oregon? He said. It's lovely this time of year.
Chapter 33. We all stared at Ogden Morrow in stunned silence. How did you get in here? H finally asked, once he'd managed to pick his jaw up off the floor. This is a private chat room.
Yes, I know, Morrow said, looking a bit embarrassed. I'm afraid I've been eavesdropping on the four of you for quite some time now, and I hope you'll accept my sincere apologies for invading your privacy. I did it with only the best intentions, I promise you.
With all due respect, sir, Artemis said, you didn't answer his question. How did you gain access to this chat room without an invitation, and without any of us even knowing you were here?
Forgive me, he said. I can see why this might concern you. But you needn't worry. My avatar has many unique powers, including the ability to enter private chat rooms uninvited. As Morrow spoke, he walked over to one of H's bookshelves and began to browse through some vintage role-playing game supplements. Prior to the original launch of the Oasis, when Jim and I created our avatars, we gave ourselves super user access to the entire simulation. In addition to being immortal and invincible, our avatars could go pretty much anywhere and do pretty much anything. Now that Anorak is gone, my avatar is the only one with these powers. He turned to face the four of us. No one else has the ability to eavesdrop on you, especially not the Sixers. Oasis chat room encryption protocols are rock solid, I assure you. He chuckled lightly. My presence here notwithstanding.
He knocked over that stack of comic books, I said to H. After our first meeting in here, remember? I told you it wasn't a software glitch.
Og nodded and gave us a guilty shrug. That was me. I can be pretty clumsy at times.
There was another brief silence, during which I finally worked up the courage to speak to Morrow directly. Mr. Morrow, I began.
Please, Morrow said, raising a hand. Call me Og.
All right, I said, laughing nervously. Even under the circumstances, I was completely starstruck. I couldn't believe I was actually addressing the Ogden Morrow.
Og,
would you mind telling us why you've been eavesdropping on us?
Because I want to help you, he replied. And from what I heard a moment ago, it sounds as though you could all use my help.
We all exchanged nervous looks, and Og seemed to detect our skepticism.
Please, don't misunderstand me. He continued, I'm not going to give you any clues or provide you with any information to help you reach the egg. That would ruin all the fun, wouldn't it?
He walked back over to us, and his tone turned serious. Just before he died, I promised Jim that in his absence I would do everything I could to protect the spirit and integrity of his contest. That's why I'm here. But sir, Og, I said, in your autobiography, you wrote that you and James Halliday didn't speak during the last 10 years of his life.
Morrow gave me an amused smile. Come on, kid, he said. You can't believe everything you read. He laughed. Actually, that statement was mostly true. I didn't speak with Jim for the last decade of his life, not until just a few weeks before he died.
He paused, as if calling up the memory.
At the time, I didn't even know he was sick. He just called me up out of the blue, and we met in a private chat room, much like this one. Then he told me about his illness, the contest, and what he had planned. He was worried there might still be a few bugs in the gates, or that complications might arise after he was gone that would prevent the contest from proceeding as he'd intended.
You mean like the Sixers? Shoto asked.
Exactly, Og said. Like the Sixers. So Jim asked me to monitor the contest and to intervene if it ever became necessary.
He scratched his beard.
To be honest, I didn't really want the responsibility, but it was the dying wish of my oldest friend, so I agreed. And for the past 6 years, I've watched from the sidelines. And even though the Sixers have done everything to stack the odds against you, somehow you four have persevered. But now, after hearing you describe your current circumstances, I think the time has finally come for me to take action to maintain the integrity of Jim's game.
Artemis, Shoto, H, and I all exchanged looks of amazement, as if seeking reassurance from one another that this was all really happening.
I want to offer the four of you sanctuary at my home here in Oregon, Og said. From here, you'll be able to execute your plan and complete your quest in safety without having to worry about Sixer agents tracking you down and kicking in your door. I can provide each of you with a state-of-the-art immersion rig, a fiber optic connection to the Oasis, and anything else you might need. Another stunned silence. Thank you, sir, I finally blurted out, resisting the urge to fall to my knees and bow repeatedly. It's the least I can do.
That's an incredibly kind offer, Mr. Morrow, Shoto said. But I live in Japan.
I know, Shoto, Og said. I've already chartered a private jet for you. It's waiting at the Osaka airport. If you send me your current location, I'll arrange for a limo to pick you up and take you to the runway.
Shoto was speechless for a second. Then he bowed low. Arigato, Morrow-san.
Don't mention it, kid. He turned to Artemis. Young lady, I understand that you're currently at the Vancouver airport. I've made travel arrangements for you as well. A driver is currently waiting for you in the baggage claim area, holding a sign with the name Benatar on it. He'll take you to the plane I've chartered for you. For a second, I thought Artemis might bow too. But then she ran over and threw her arms around Og in a bear hug.
Thank you, Og, she said. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're welcome, dear, he said with an embarrassed laugh. When she finally released him, he turned to H and me. H, I understand that you have a vehicle and that you're currently in the vicinity of Pittsburgh. H nodded. If you wouldn't mind driving to Columbus to retrieve your friend Parzival here, I'll arrange for a jet to pick up both of you at the Columbus airport. That is, if you boys don't mind sharing a ride?
No, that sounds perfect, H said, glancing at me sideways. Thanks, Og.
Yes, thank you, I repeated. You're a lifesaver. I hope so.
He gave me a grim smile, then turned to address everyone.
Safe travels, all of you. I'll see you soon.
And then he vanished, just as quickly as he'd appeared.
Well, this blows, I said, turning to H. Artemis and Shoto get limos, and I have to bum a ride to the airport with your ugly ass in some shit heap RV?
It's not a shit heap, H said, laughing. And you're welcome to take a cab, asshole.
This is going to be interesting, I said, stealing a quick glance at Artemis.
The four of us are finally going to meet in person.
It will be an honor, Shoto said. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, Artemis said, locking eyes with me.
I can't wait.
After Shoto and Artemis logged out, I gave H my current location. It's a plug franchise. Call me when you get here and I'll meet you out front.
Will do, he said.
Listen, I should warn you, I don't look anything like my avatar.
So? Who does? I'm not really this tall or muscular, and my nose is slightly bigger. I'm just warning you. Meeting me might be kind of a shock for you.
Okay, then why don't you just tell me what you look like right now?
I'm already on the road, he said, ignoring my question. I'll see you in a few hours, okay?
Okay. Drive safe, amigo.
Despite what I'd said to H, knowing that I was about to meet him in person after all these years made me more nervous than I wanted to admit, but it was nothing compared to the apprehension I already felt building inside me at the prospect of meeting Artemis once we reached Oregon. Trying to picture the actual moment filled me with a mixture of excitement and abject terror. What would she be like in person? Was the photo I'd seen in her file actually a fake? Did I still have any kind of chance with her at all? With a Herculean effort, I managed to put her out of my mind by forcing myself to focus on the approaching battle. As soon as I logged out of H's basement, I sent out my call to arms email as a global announcement to every Oasis user. Knowing most of those emails wouldn't get through the spam filters, I also posted it to every Gunter message board.
Then I made a short vidcap recording of my avatar reading it aloud and set it to run on a continuous loop on my POV channel. The word spread quickly. Within an hour, our plan to assault Castle Anorak was the top story on every single news feed, accompanied by headlines like, "Gunters declare all-out war on the Sixers," and "Top Gunters accuse IOI of kidnapping and murder," and "Is the hunt for Halliday's egg finally over?" Some of the news feeds were already running the video clip of Diato's murder I'd sent them, along with the text of Sorrento's memo, citing an anonymous source for both. So far, IOI had declined to comment on either. By now, Sorrento would know I'd somehow gained access to the Sixers' private database. I wished I could see his face when he learned how I'd done it, that I'd spent an entire week just a few floors below his office. I spent the next few hours outfitting my avatar and preparing myself mentally for what was to come. When I could no longer keep my eyes open, I decided to catch a quick nap while I waited for H to arrive. I disabled the auto logout feature on my account, then drifted off in the haptic chair with my new jacket draped over me as a blanket, clutching in one hand the pistol I'd purchased earlier that day. I woke with a start sometime later to the sound of H's ringtone. He was calling to let me know he'd arrived outside. I climbed out of the rig, collected my things, and returned the rented gear at the front desk. When I stepped out into the street, I saw that night had fallen. The frozen air hit me like a bucket of ice water. H's tiny RV was just a few yards away, parked at the curb. It was a mocha-colored Sunrider, about 20 feet long and at least 2 decades old. A patchwork of solar cells covered the RV's roof and most of its body, along with a liberal amount of rust. The windows were tinted black, so I couldn't see inside. I took a deep breath and crossed the slush-covered sidewalk, feeling a strange combination of dread and excitement. As I approached the RV, a door near the center of the right side slid open and a short stepladder extended to the pavement. I climbed inside, and the door slid shut behind me. I found myself in the RV's tiny kitchen. It was dark, except for the running lights set into the carpeted floor. To my left, I saw a small bedroom area at the back, wedged into a loft above the RV's battery compartment. I turned and walked slowly across the darkened kitchen, then pulled back the beaded curtain covering the doorway to the cab. A heavy-set African-American girl sat in the RV's driver's seat, clutching the wheel tightly and staring straight ahead. She was about my age, with short, kinky hair and chocolate-colored skin that appeared iridescent in the soft glow of the dashboard indicators. She was wearing a vintage Rush 2112 concert t-shirt, and the numbers were warped around her large bosom. She also had on faded black jeans and a pair of studded combat boots. She appeared to be shivering, even though it was nice and warm in the cab. I stood there for a moment, staring at her in silence, waiting for her to acknowledge my presence. Eventually, she turned and smiled at me, and it was a smile I recognized immediately. That Cheshire grin I'd seen thousands of times before on the face of H's avatar, during the countless nights we'd spent together in the Oasis, telling bad jokes and watching bad movies. And her smile wasn't the only thing I found familiar. I also recognized the set of her eyes and the lines of her face. There was no doubt in my mind. The young woman sitting in front of me was my best friend, H. A wave of emotion washed over me. Shock gave way to a sense of betrayal. How could she, deceive me all these years? I felt my face flush with embarrassment as I remembered all of the adolescent intimacies I'd shared with H, a person I'd trusted implicitly, someone I thought I knew. When I didn't say anything, her eyes dropped to her boots and stayed on them. I sat down heavily in the passenger seat, still staring over at her, still unsure of what to say. She kept stealing glances at me. Then her eyes would dart away nervously. She was still trembling. Whatever anger or betrayal I felt quickly evaporated. I couldn't help myself. I started to laugh. There was no meanness in it, and I knew she could tell that because her shoulders relaxed a bit and she let out a relieved sigh. Then she started to laugh too, half laughing and half crying, I thought. "Hey, H," I said once our laughter subsided. "How goes it?" "It's going good, Z," she said. "All sunshine and rainbows." Her voice was familiar too, just not quite as deep as it was online. All this time, she'd been using software to disguise it. "Well," I said, "look at us. Here we are." "Yeah," H replied. "Here we are." An uncomfortable silence descended. I hesitated a moment, unsure of what to do. Then I followed my instincts, crossed the small space between us, and put my arms around her. "It's good to see you, old friend," I said. "Thanks for coming to get me." She returned the hug. "It's good to see you too," she said, and I could tell she meant it. I let go of her and stepped back. "Christ, H," I said, smiling. "I knew you were hiding something, but I never imagined." "What?" she said a bit defensively. "You never imagined what?" "That the famous H, renowned Gunter, and the most feared and ruthless arena combatant in the entire Oasis, was, in reality, a fat black chick?" "I was going to say young African-American woman." Her expression darkened. "There's a reason I never told you, you know." "And I'm sure it's a good one," I said. "But it really doesn't matter." "It doesn't?" "Of course not. You're my best friend, H. My only friend, to be honest." "Well, I still want to explain." "Okay. But can it wait until we're in the air?" I said. "We've got a long way to travel, and I'll feel a lot safer once we've left this city in the dust." "We're on our way, amigo," she said, putting the RV in gear. H followed Og's directions to a private hangar near the Columbus Airport, where a small luxury jet was waiting for us. Og had arranged for H's RV to be stored in a nearby hangar, but it had been her home for many years, and I could tell she was nervous about leaving it behind. We both stared at the jet in wonder as we approached it. I'd seen airplanes in the sky before, of course, but I'd never seen one up close. Traveling by jet was something only rich people could afford. That Og could afford to charter 3 different jets to retrieve us without batting an eyelash was a testament to just how insanely wealthy he must be. The jet was completely automated, so there was no crew on board. We were all alone. The placid voice of the autopilot welcomed us aboard, then told us to strap in and prepare for takeoff. We were up in the air within minutes. It was the first time either of us had ever flown, and we both spent the first hour of the flight staring out the windows, overwhelmed by the view, as we hurtled westward through the atmosphere at 10,000 feet on our way to Oregon. Finally, once some of the novelty had worn off, I could tell that H was ready to talk. "Okay, H," I said. "Tell me your story." She flashed her Cheshire grin and took a deep breath. "The whole thing was originally my mother's idea," she said. Then she launched into an abbreviated version of her life story. Her real name, she said, was Helen Harris, and she was only a few months older than I was. She'd grown up in Atlanta, raised by a single mother. Her father had died in Afghanistan when she was still a baby. Her mother, Marie, worked from home in an online data processing center. In Marie's opinion, the Oasis was the best thing that had ever happened to both women and people of color. From the very start, Marie had used a white male avatar to conduct all of her online business because of the marked difference it made in how she was treated
and the opportunities she was given. When H first logged into the Oasis, she followed her mother's advice and created a Caucasian male avatar. H had been her mother's nickname for her since she was a baby, so she'd decided to use it as the name of her online persona. A few years later, when she started attending school online, her mother lied about her daughter's race and gender on the application. H was required to provide a photo for her school profile, so she'd submitted a photorealistic rendering of her male avatar's face, which she'd modeled after her own features. H told me that she hadn't seen or spoken to her mother since leaving home on her 18th birthday. That was the day H had finally come out to her mother about her sexuality. At first, her mother refused to believe she was gay. But then Helen revealed that she'd been dating a girl she met online for nearly a year. As H explained all of this, I could tell she was studying my reaction. I wasn't all that surprised, really. Over the past few years, H and I had discussed our mutual admiration for the female form on numerous occasions. I was actually relieved to know that H hadn't been deceiving me, at least not on that account. "How did your mother react when she found out you had a girlfriend?" I asked. "Well, it turns out that my mother had her own set of deep-seated prejudices," H said. "She kicked me out of the house and said she never wanted to see me again. I was homeless for a little while. I lived in a series of shelters. But eventually I earned enough competing in the Oasis Arena Leagues to buy my RV, and I've been living in it ever since. I usually only stop moving when the RV's batteries need to recharge." As we continued to talk, going through the motions of getting to know each other, I realized that we already did know each other, as well as any two people could. We'd known each other for years, in the most intimate way possible. We'd connected on a purely mental level. I understood her, trusted her, and loved her as a dear friend. None of that had changed, or could be changed, by anything as inconsequential as her gender, or skin color, or sexual orientation. The rest of the flight seemed to go by in a blink. H and I quickly fell into our old familiar rhythm, and before long it was like we were back in the basement, trash-talking each other over a game of Quake or Joust. Any fears I had about the resiliency of our friendship in the real world had vanished by the time our jet touched down on Og's private runway in Oregon. We'd been flying west across the country, just a few hours ahead of the sunrise, so it was still dark when we landed. H and I both froze in our tracks as we stepped off the plane, gazing in wonder at the scene around us. Even in the dim moonlight, the view was breathtaking. The dark, towering silhouettes of the Wallawa Mountains surrounded us on all sides. Rows of blue runway lights stretched out along the valley floor behind us, delineating Og's private landing strip. Directly ahead, a steep cobblestone staircase at the edge of the runway led up to a grand, floodlit mansion constructed on a plateau near the base of the mountain range. Several waterfalls were visible in the distance, spilling off the peaks beyond Morrow's mansion. "It looks just like Rivendell," H said, taking the words right out of my mouth. I nodded. "It looks exactly like Rivendell in the Lord of the Rings movies," I said, still staring up at it in awe. "Og's wife was a big Tolkien fan, remember? He built this place for her." We heard an electric hum behind us as the jet staircase retracted and the hatch closed. The engines powered back up and the jet rotated, preparing to take off again. We stood and watched it launch back up into the clear, starry sky. Then we turned and began to mount the staircase leading up to the house. When we finally reached the top, Ogden Morrow was there, waiting for us.
"Welcome, my friends!" Og bellowed, extending both his hands in greeting. He was dressed in a plaid bathrobe and bunny slippers. "Welcome to my home!"
"Thank you, sir,"
H said. Thanks for inviting us here.
Ah, you must be H, he replied, clasping her hand. If he was surprised by her appearance, he didn't show it. I recognize your voice. He gave her a wink, followed by a bear hug. Then he turned and hugged me, too. And you must be Wade. I mean, Parzival. Welcome, welcome. It's truly an honor to meet you both.
The honor is ours, I said. We really can't thank you enough for helping us.
You've already thanked me enough, so stop it, he said. He turned and led us across an expansive green lawn toward his enormous house. I can't tell you how good it is to have visitors. Sad to say, I've been all alone here since Kira died.
He was silent a moment, then he laughed.
Alone except for my cooks, maids, and gardeners, of course. But they all live here too, so they don't really count as visitors.
Neither I nor H knew how to reply, so we just kept smiling and nodding. Eventually, I worked up the courage to speak.
Have the others arrived yet? Shoto and Artemis?
Something about the way I said Artemis made Moro chuckle long and loud. After a few seconds, I realized H was laughing at me too.
What?
I said.
What's so funny?
Yes, Og said, grinning. Artemis arrived first several hours ago, and Shoto's plane got here about 30 minutes before you arrived.
Are we going to meet them now? I asked, doing an extremely poor job of hiding my apprehension.
Og shook his head. Artemis felt that meeting you two right now would be an unnecessary distraction. She wanted to wait until after the big event, and Shoto seemed to agree. He studied me for a moment. It probably is for the best, you know. You've all got a big day ahead of you.
I nodded, feeling a strange combination of relief and disappointment.
Where are they now? H asked.
Og raised a fist triumphantly in the air.
They're already logged in, preparing for your assault on the Sixers.
His voice echoed across the grounds and off the high stone walls of his mansion.
Follow me! The hour draws near!
Og's enthusiasm pulled me back into the moment, and I felt a nervous knot form in the pit of my stomach. We followed our bath-robed benefactor across the expansive moonlit courtyard. As we approached the main house, we passed a small gated-in garden filled with flowers. The garden was in a strange location, and I couldn't figure out its purpose until I saw the large tombstone at its center. Then I realized it must be Kira Moro's grave. But even in the bright moonlight, it was still too dark for me to make out the inscription on the headstone. Og led us through the mansion's lavish front entrance. The lights were off inside, but instead of turning them on, Moro took an honest-to-God torch off the wall and used it to illuminate our way. Even in dim torchlight, the grandeur of the place amazed me. Giant tapestries and a huge collection of fantasy artwork covered the walls, while gargoyle statues and suits of armor lined the hallways. As we followed Og, I worked up enough courage to speak to him.
Listen, I know this probably isn't the time, I said, but I'm a huge fan of your work. I grew up playing Halcedonia Interactive's educational games. They taught me how to read, write, do math, solve puzzles.
I proceeded to ramble on as we walked, raving about all of my favorite Halcedonia titles and geeking out on Og in a classically embarrassing fashion. H must have thought I was brown-nosing because she snickered throughout my stammering monologue, but Og was very cool about it.
That's wonderful to hear, he said, seeming genuinely pleased. My wife and I were very proud of those games. I'm so glad you have fond memories of them.
We rounded a corner, and H and I both froze before the entrance of a giant room filled with row after row of old video games. We both knew it must be James Halliday's classic video game collection, the collection he'd willed to Morrow after his death. Og glanced around and saw us lingering by the entrance, then hurried back to retrieve us. "I promise to give you a tour later, when all the excitement is over," Og said, his breathing a bit labored. He was moving quickly for a man his age and size. He led us down a spiral stone staircase to an elevator that carried us down several more floors to Og's basement. The decor here was much more modern. We followed Og through a maze of carpeted hallways until we reached a row of seven circular doorways, each numbered. "And here we are," Morrow said, gesturing with the torch. "These are my Oasis immersion bays. They're all top-of-the-line Habishaw rigs, OIR 9400s.
9400s? No kidding? H let out a low whistle. Wicked.
"Where are the others?" I asked, looking around nervously. "Artemis and Shoto are already in bays 2 and 3, he said. "Bay 1 is mine. You two can take your pick of the others."
I stared at the doors, wondering which one Artemis was behind.
Og motioned to the end of the hall. "You'll find haptic suits of all sizes in the dressing rooms. Now, get yourselves suited and booted."
He smiled wide when H and I emerged from the dressing rooms a few minutes later, each dressed in brand new haptic suits and gloves.
"Excellent," Og said. "Now, grab a bay and log in. The clock is ticking."
H turned to face me. I could tell she wanted to say something, but words seemed to fail her. After a few seconds, she stuck out her gloved hand. I took it.
"Good luck, H," I said.
"Good luck, Z," she replied. Then she turned to Og and said, "Thanks again, Og." Before he could respond, she stood on her tiptoes and kissed him on the cheek. Then she disappeared through the door to Bay 4, and it hissed shut behind her. Og grinned after her, then turned to face me.
"The whole world is rooting for the four of you. Try not to let them down."
"We'll do our best."
"I know you will." He offered me his hand, and I shook it. I took a step toward my immersion bay, then turned back. "Og, can I ask you one question?" I said. He raised an eyebrow.
"If you're going to ask me what's inside the third gate, I have no idea," he said.
"And even if I did, I wouldn't tell you. You should know that."
I shook my head. "No, that's not it. I wanted to ask what it was that ended your friendship with Halliday. In all the research I've done, I've never been able to find out. What happened?"
Morrow studied me for a moment. He'd been asked this question in interviews many times before and had always ignored it. I don't know why he decided to tell me. Maybe he'd been waiting all these years to tell someone.
"It was because of Kira, my wife."
He paused a moment, then cleared his throat and continued.
"Like me, he'd been in love with her since high school. Of course, he never had the courage to act on it, so she never knew how he felt about her. And neither did I. He didn't tell me about it until the last time I spoke to him, right before he died. Even then, it was hard for him to communicate with me. Jim was never very good with people or with expressing his emotions." I nodded silently and waited for him to continue. "Even after Kira and I got engaged, I think Jim still harbored some fantasy of stealing her away from me. But once we got married, he abandoned that notion. He told me he'd stopped speaking to me because of the overwhelming jealousy he felt. Kira was the only woman he ever loved." Morrow's voice caught in his throat. "I can understand why Jim felt that way. Kira was very special. It was impossible not to fall in love with her." He smiled at me. "You know what it's like to meet someone like that,"
don't you?
I do, I said. Then, when I realized he had no more to say on the subject, I said,
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Thank you for telling me all of that.
You're quite welcome, he said. Then he walked over to his immersion bay, and the door irised open. Inside, I could see that his rig had been modified to include several strange components, including an Oasis console modified to look like a vintage Commodore 64. He glanced back at me.
Good luck, Parzival. You're going to need it.
What are you going to do, I asked, during the fight?
Sit back and watch, of course, he said. This looks to be the most epic battle in video game history.
He grinned at me one last time, then stepped through the door and was gone, leaving me alone in the dimly lit hallway. I spent a few minutes thinking about everything Morrow had told me. Then I walked over to my own immersion bay and stepped inside. It was a small spherical room. A gleaming haptic chair was suspended on a jointed hydraulic arm attached to the ceiling. There was no omnidirectional treadmill because the room itself served that function. While you were logged in, you could walk or run in any direction, and the sphere would rotate around and beneath you, preventing you from ever touching the wall. It was like being inside a giant hamster ball. I climbed into the chair and felt it adjust to fit the contours of my body. A robotic arm extended from the chair and slipped a brand new Oculus visor onto my face. It, too, adjusted so that it fit perfectly. The visor scanned my retinas, and the system prompted me to speak my new passphrase, Reindeer Flotilla SeaTech Astronomy. I took a deep breath as the system logged me in.
Chapter 34. I was ready to rock. My avatar was buffed to the eyeballs and armed to the teeth. I was packing as many magic items and as much firepower as I could squeeze into my inventory. Everything was in place. Our plan was in motion. It was time to go. I entered my stronghold's hangar and pressed a button on the wall to open the launch doors. They slid back, slowly revealing the launch tunnel leading up to Falco's surface. I walked to the end of the runway, past my X-Wing and the Vonnegut. I wouldn't be taking either of them today. They were both good ships, with formidable weapons and defenses. But neither craft would offer much protection in the epic shitstorm that was about to unfold on Thonia. Fortunately, I now had a new mode of transportation. I removed the 12-inch Leopardon robot from my avatar's inventory and set it down gently on the runway. Shortly before I'd been arrested by IOI, I'd taken some time to examine the toy Leopardon robot and ascertain its powers. As I suspected, the robot was actually a powerful magical item. It hadn't taken me long to figure out the command word required to activate it. Just like in Toei's original Supaidaman TV series, you summoned the robot simply by shouting its name. I did this now, taking the precaution of backing away from the robot a good distance before shouting, Leopardon! I heard a piercing shriek that sounded like rending metal. A second later, the once tiny robot had grown to a height of almost 100 meters. The top of the robot's head now protruded through the open launch doors in the hangar ceiling. I gazed up at the towering robot, admiring the attention to detail Halliday had put into coding it. Every feature of the original Japanese mech had been recreated, including its giant gleaming sword and spiderweb-embossed shield. A tiny access door was set into the robot's massive left foot, and it opened as I approached, revealing a small elevator inside. It carried me up through the interior of the robot's leg and torso to the cockpit located inside its armored chest. As I seated myself in the captain's chair, I spotted a silver control bracelet in a clear case on the wall. I took it out
and snapped it onto my avatar's wrist. The bracelet would allow me to use voice commands to control the robot while I was outside it. Several rows of buttons were set into the command console in front of me, all labeled in Japanese. I pressed one of them, and the engines roared to life. Then I hit the throttle, and the twin rocket boosters in each of the robot's feet ignited, launching it upward, out of my stronghold, and into Falco's star-filled sky. I noticed that Halliday had added an old 8-track tape player to the cockpit control panel. There was also a rack of 8-track tapes mounted over my right shoulder. I grabbed one and slapped it into the deck. "Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap" by AC/DC began to blast out of the robot's internal and external speakers, so loud it made my chair vibrate. As soon as the robot was clear of my hangar, I shouted, "Change Marveler!" into the control bracelet. The voice commands appeared to work only if you shouted them. The robot's legs, arms, and head folded inward and locked into new positions, transforming the robot into a starship known as the Marveler. Once the transformation was complete, I left Falco's orbit and set a course for the nearest Stargate. When I emerged from the Stargate in Sector 10, my radar screen lit up like a Christmas tree. Thousands of space vehicles of every make and model were crawling through the starry blackness around me. Everything from single-seater craft to giant moon-sized freighters. I'd never seen so many starships in one place. A steady stream of them poured out of the Stargate, while others converged on the area from every direction in the sky. All of the ships gradually funneled together, forming a long, haphazard caravan of vessels stretching toward Thonia, a tiny, blue-brown orb floating in the distance. It looked like every single person in the oasis was headed for Castle Anorak. I felt a brief surge of exhilaration, even though I knew Artemis's warning might still prove true. There was a chance most of these avatars were here only to watch the show and had no intention of actually risking their lives to fight the Sixers. Artemis. After all this time, she was now in a room just a few feet away from me. We would actually be meeting in person as soon as this fight was over. The thought should have terrified me, but instead, I felt a zen calm wash over me. Whatever was going to happen down on Thonia, everything I'd risked had already been worth it. I transformed the Marveler back into its robot configuration, then joined the long parade of spacecraft. My ship stood out in the vast array of vessels, since it was the only giant robot. A cloud of smaller ships quickly formed around me, piloted by curious avatars zooming in for a closer look at Leopardon. I had to mute my comlink because so many different people were trying to hail me, asking who the hell I was and where I'd picked up such a sweet ride. As the planet Thonia grew larger in my cockpit window, the density and number of ships around me seemed to increase exponentially. When I finally entered the planet's atmosphere and began to descend toward the surface, it was like flying through a swarm of metal insects. When I reached the area around Castle Anorak, I had a hard time believing my eyes. A concentrated, pulsing mass of ships and avatars covered the ground and filled the air. It was like some otherworldly Woodstock. Shoulder-to-shoulder avatars stretched to the horizon in all directions. Thousands more floated and flew through the air above, dodging the constant influx of ships. And, at the center of all this insanity, stood Castle Anorak itself, an onyx jewel gleaming beneath the Sixers' transparent, spherical shield. Every few seconds, some hapless avatar or ship would inadvertently fly or careen into the shield and get vaporized like a fly hitting a bug zapper. When I got closer, I spotted an open patch of ground directly in front of the castle's entrance, just outside the shield wall. Three giant figures stood side by side at the center of the clearing. The crowd around them was continuously surging inward and then receding as avatars pushed back against each other to try to keep a respectful distance from H, Artemis, and Shoto, who each sat inside their own gleaming giant robot. This was my first opportunity to see which robots H, Artemis, and Shoto had selected after clearing the second gate, and it took me a moment to place the towering female robot Artemis was piloting. It was black and chrome in color, with elaborate boomerang-shaped headgear and symmetrical red breastplates that made it look like a female version of Transor Z. Then I realized it was the female version of Transor Z, an obscure character from the original Mazinger Z anime series known as Minerva X. H had selected an RX-78 Gundam mech from the original Mobile Suit Gundam anime series, one of his longtime favorites. Even though I now knew H was actually a female in real life, her avatar was still male, so I decided to continue to refer to him as such. Shoto stood several heads taller than both of them, concealed inside the cockpit of Raidene, the enormous red and blue robot from the mid-70s Brave Raidene anime series. The massive mech clutched his signature golden bow in one hand and had a large spiked shield strapped to the other. A roar swept through the crowd as I flew in low over the shield and rocketed to a halt above the others. I rotated my orientation so that Leopardon was upright, then cut the engines and dropped the remaining distance to the surface. My robot landed on one knee, and the impact shook the ground. As I stood it upright, the sea of onlookers began to chant my avatar's name. Parzival! Parzival! As the chanting faded back to a dull roar, I turned to face my companions. Nice entrance, you big show-off, Artemis said, using our private comlink channel. Did you show up late on purpose? Not my fault, I swear, I said, trying to play it cool. There was a long line at the Stargate. H nodded his mech's massive head. Every transport terminal on the planet has been spitting out avatars since last night, he said, motioning to the scene around us with his Gundam's massive hand. This is unreal. I've never seen so many ships or avatars in one place. Me neither, Artemis said. I'm surprised the GSS servers can handle the load with so much activity in one sector, but there doesn't seem to be any lag at all. I took a long look at the sea of avatars around us, then shifted my attention to the castle. Thousands of flying avatars and ships continued to buzz around the shield, occasionally firing bullets, lasers, missiles, and other projectiles at it, all of which impacted harmlessly on the surface. Inside the sphere, thousands of power-armored Sixer avatars stood in silent formation, completely encircling the castle. Interspersed through their ranks were rows of hover tanks and gunships. In any other setting, the Sixer army would have appeared formidable, maybe even unstoppable. But in the face of the endless mob that now surrounded them, the Sixers looked woefully outnumbered and outmatched. So, Parzival, said Shoto, turning his robot's huge head in my direction. It's showtime, old friend. If that sphere doesn't come down like you promised, this is going to be pretty embarrassing. Han will have that shield down, H quoted. We've got to give him more time. I laughed, then used my robot's right hand to tap the back of its left wrist, indicating the time. H is right. It's still 6 minutes to noon. The end of my sentence was drowned out by another roar from the crowd. Directly in front of us, inside the sphere, the massive front doors of Castle Anorak had just swung open. And now, a single Sixer avatar was emerging from within. Sorrento. Grinning at the din of booing and hissing that greeted his arrival, Sorrento waved his hand at the Sixer troops stationed directly in front of the castle
and they immediately scattered, clearing a large, open space. Sorrento stepped forward into it, positioning himself directly opposite us, just a few dozen yards away, on the other side of the shield. 10 other Sixer avatars emerged from the castle and positioned themselves behind Sorrento, each of them standing a good distance apart.
"I have a bad feeling about this," Artemis muttered into her headset.
"Yeah," H whispered. "Me too."
Sorrento surveyed the scene, then smiled up at us. When he spoke, his voice was amplified through powerful speakers mounted on the Sixer gunships and hover tanks, allowing him to be heard by everyone in the area. And since there were cameras and reporters from every major newsfeed outlet present, I knew his words were being broadcast to the entire world.
"Welcome to Castle Anorak," Sorrento said. "We've been expecting you."
He made a sweeping gesture, indicating the angry mob that surrounded him.
"I must say, we are a bit surprised so many of you showed up here today. By now it must be obvious to even the most ignorant among you that nothing can get past our shield."
His proclamation was met with a deafening roar of shouted threats, insults, and colorful profanity. I waited a moment, then raised both of my robot's hands, calling for quiet. Once a semblance of silence had descended, I got on the public comm channel, which had the same effect as turning on a giant PA system. I dialed my headset volume down to kill the feedback, then said,
"You're wrong, Sorrento. We're coming in. At noon. All of us."
A roar of approval erupted from the assembled Gunters. Sorrento didn't bother waiting for it to die down.
"You're welcome to try," he said, still grinning. Then he produced an item from his inventory and placed it on the ground in front of him. I zoomed in for a closer look and felt the muscles in my jaw tighten. It was a toy robot, a bipedal dinosaur with armor-plated skin and a pair of large cannons mounted on its shoulder blades. I recognized it immediately from several turn-of-the-century Japanese monster flicks. It was Mechagodzilla.
"Kiryu!" Sorrento shouted, his voice still amplified.
At the sound of the command word, his tiny robot instantly grew in size until it stood almost as tall as Castle Anorak itself, twice the height of the giant robots that H, Shoto, Artemis, and I piloted. The mechanical lizard's armored head almost touched the top of the spherical shield. An awestruck silence fell over the crowd, followed by a rumble of fearful recognition from the thousands of Gunters present. They all recognized this giant metal behemoth, and they all knew it was nearly indestructible. Sorrento entered the mech through an access door in one of its massive heels. A few seconds later, the beast's eyes began to glow bright yellow. Then it threw back its head, opened its jagged maw, and let out a piercing metallic roar. On cue, the 10 Sixer avatars standing behind Sorrento pulled out their toy robots and activated them, too. 5 of them had the huge robotic lions that could form Voltron. The other 5 had giant mechs from Robotech and Neon Genesis Evangelion.
"Oh, shit,"
I heard Artemis and H whisper in unison.
"Come on," Sorrento shouted defiantly. His challenge echoed across the crowded landscape.
Many of the Gunters on the front lines took an involuntary step backward. A few others turned and ran for their lives. But H, Shoto, Artemis, and I held our ground. I checked the time on my display. Less than a minute to go now. I pressed a button on Leopardon's control panel, and my giant robot drew its gleaming sword. I didn't witness it firsthand, but I can tell you with some certainty
that this is what happened next. The Sixers had erected a large armored bunker behind Castle Anorak, filled with pallets of weapons and battle gear that had been teleported in by the Sixers before they activated their shield. There was also a long rack of